We're talking here about prostate cancer. You were given the job of looking at science, things like genetic profiling in primary prostate cancer. So looking ahead in prostate cancer, looking at the genes, finding out what might happen and what the risks are and what the treatments should be. That's an issue you've made a lot of thought about and done a lot of research into the background science. Can I ask you, why is this important?
Well, there are about 47,000 men diagnosed with prostate cancer every year in the UK. And we don't know which ones are going to die of prostate cancer and which ones can be left untreated for the rest of their lives. Genetics is one tool to allow us to understand that.
Well, obviously it would be great if you could just test a primary prostate cancer cell and predict what its behaviour is going to be, what its response to drugs would be. What about the heterogeneous nature of this disease? Heterogeneity is something that has come up in your talk here at the conference.
This is the $100,000, maybe with inflation, million-dollar question. Because it's heterogeneous, people will tend to look at the biggest tumour or they'll tend to look at the tumour that's most easily recognisable. And that's often not the most malignant cancer. And we've got to get away from this to find methods where we can identify the most dangerous cell in situ. And we're still not there. And I think that was roughly the sort of message I was coming across with.
And in terms of genomic profiling, what do you mean?
This is looking at two things. First of all, we're looking at mutations that have developed in the cancer cell that aren't in the other cells in the body. And if these mutations result in changes to the cell that we can target or identify, we either have a new treatment, in the case of targeting, or we have a biomarker in the case of other changes.
And what exactly is the heterogeneity that you feel confuses the issue?
Well, first of all, there's cellular heterogeneity. If you were to stick a needle into a tumour, you would come out with tumour cells, you would come out with stromal cells, you would come out with normal cells, and if it was immunologically active, you'd come out with a whole variety of immune cells plus blood vessel cells. And yet they're all treated the same when it comes time to doing the genomic analysis. So the dangerous mutations will be diluted out by the rest of the cells.
And I heard some mention of the fact that in prostate cancer, many of the cells are not very different.
This seems to be the case, that there's an area of cancer, but around about it, there appears to be a field of cells which are activated to become cancer. So if you think of cancer as a sort of series of choices walking down a road, sometimes the cancer cell will turn left and become an unpleasant cancer. Sometimes it will turn right and it will remain as a relatively indolent cancer, is the best word.
And I think you were saying that it's something like normal genes being rearranged.
That's exactly right. The gene complement in many prostate cancers is almost exactly the same. It's certainly more than 99% identical to the original normal tissue. It's just the idea that a critical gene becomes mutated and that triggers the whole cancer event.
So if you're looking at genomic profiling, what sorts of things would be ideal to look for?
Well, first of all, we now know, courtesy of the papers I presented, we know a catalogue of mutations which are likely to occur in prostate cancer. So scientists have developed panels which are specific for those, and this simplifies the whole method of looking for these mutational changes. And you'll find them coming into clinical diagnostic use. But essentially what I was doing was warning that they may not cover more than 75% of cancers, and that's about the same sensitivity that the PSA test has in determining whether a man has cancers. So it's not that much better.
But there are many, many mutations associated with prostate cancer, and indeed the disease itself is a moving target.
There are many mutations, but they're a fraction of the number that are present in lung cancer, in melanoma, and in actually almost every other solid cancer, including breast cancer. So prostate cancer appears to be mutagenically quite separate from the other cancers. It has gene rearrangements as well, And they seem to be diagnostic, but they're diagnostic at the moment for good prognosis rather than bad prognosis. So they're not the ideal tools to be able to use.
So are you hopeful that genomic profiling will become or could become a powerful tool in attacking prostate cancer?
Oh, I believe that for more than 20 years, and I haven't changed my opinion. I think the point I'm trying to make is that it must be used with consideration rather than as a blanket tool. Because if these tests begin to fail, then the public will lose trust in them, the doctors will lose trust in them, the blame will be transferred back to the scientists to say they haven't been tested adequately, and then we'll have to go around the whole cycle again to build up that confidence. I'm sure it will happen, yes.
Now, could I ask you about the field effect? Because you have raised this whole question of the cancer being treated locally might not be good enough. What do you mean by this?
Well, this is work that came from a colleague of mine, Professor Colin Cooper, the University of East Anglia. And what Colin did was to look in a very open way at the whole prostates taken out of patients. And he found that there were little areas of tumour, but round about them, there were cells which were looked normal, but they had the right mutations to be a cancer. And this suggests that these are cells that are primed to become a cancer, and they just need that little extra push to develop all the way. So you could cut out the cancer, or you could focally treat the cancer, but you probably wouldn't extend it into the whole field. And those cells in the field can then recur and, with time, develop a fresh cancer.
In terms of treatment, what potentially might be done about the field effect?
Well, I hope, when talking to an audience of surgeons, radical prostatectomy appears to be the way to get about it. But I think if you can find a way to image the genetics of the cancer rather than its appearance, then you could extend the focal therapy to as much of the field as you can get. And radiotherapy is very often a case of killing as much as you can without damaging the rest of the tissue. And this appears to be no different.
Now, there are questions being raised about biopsy as being a worthwhile modality because it depends, apparently, on which part of the tumour you biopsy.
This is really a point of interest. Normally, the surgeon would do 6 biopsies, sometimes 12 biopsies. And if you look at them carefully, you'll find that many of them are different. They have different mutations. They have slightly different Gleason grades as well. So which one are we treating? And I don't know how. Essentially, they say the worst one, we will treat according to the worst of those. And I don't have a problem with that. I think that's as good as you will get. But what happens if there's a tiny area of cancer which has got a very malignant phenotype, and this sextant or double sextant biopsy misses that particular? And that's where we need good imaging that will reveal the entirety of the prostate to the surgeon before he takes any action, lighting up all of the areas of cancer.
Now, single-cell genomics is another issue, and perhaps potentially throwing away cells that matter.
Yes. When you do single-cell sequencing, first of all, it's at the moment it remains a very expensive toy. You can do probably hundreds of cells. In order to cover a tumour, you probably will have to do thousands of cells, and the technology will be here very soon to do this. The danger we have is that you will try to sequence a cell you recognise as being cancer. We go back to the field effect. It could be there's a cell with absolutely normal appearance which harbours all the cancer-causing mutations. And we'd throw it away. We could sequence it, but we'd throw it away. And if it came up with a mutation in a normal cell, then everybody would say, it's an artifact. We've made a mistake. We'll reject that one. And if you look at some of the papers, that's actually in there. People have rejected mutations as a problem with the technology rather than a problem with the biology. And I don't think that's scientific as far as I'm concerned.
And how can you get over that sort of problem?
You have to retain an open mind when you're doing the science. A long time ago, I was lucky enough to get some lectures from Karl Popper, the philosopher. And that was what he said. There are too many people throwing away data because it doesn't fit their hypothesis. In fact, you should change the hypothesis to embrace the data. And because of the desire for positive effects, and we all want this, we all want a better treatment for prostate cancer, there may be a tendency in some cases to push some of that data aside.
And what is this issue about silent mutations?
There's an assumption in genetics that if you have a mutation in a gene, the mutant gene will cause a phenotype, will affect the cells. It turns out that that's probably not true. And this has come to a big shock, and a lot of people still don't believe it. So we're talking on the limits of current scientific thinking. And the paper I referred to was not in prostate, but was in multiple myeloma, where a very, very good cast of scientists and clinicians determined not only the mutation spectrum from 70 genes, but also whether those genes were active. And they found that 70% of those genes, which were mutated, which potentially caused cancer, were not expressed in the cancer cell at all. Now, I offered to explain why that is. And the probable answer is that the genes that were mutated were probably needed when the cancer was starting. Once they come to a fully developed cancer mass, those genes may not be required anymore, so they may simply be switched off by the cell. But which ones they are could be incredibly important in deciding how a cancer starts, but will be useless if you were designed a treatment against them. And we have a situation with lung cancer and melanoma where people are sequencing the tumours and then designing therapies against the mutant genes, which we can do now with great precision, but they didn't ever check to see whether the mutant gene was being expressed in the first place.
I was also dismayed to hear that, in fact, treating prostate cancer causes a whole array of new mutations to flourish. What do you mean by that, and what can be done about it?
Every time you treat a cancer, you are selecting for survivors. And sometimes if you treat the cancer with a minimal dose of therapy, the drug doesn't work quickly enough and allows the resistant cells to develop. With prostate cancer, the first drive in this adaptation is either to mutate the androgen receptor gene or to amplify it. And this comes about because the drugs are damping down the androgen response, which is critical in the growth of prostate cancer. And the cell needs to find a new way to respond to these minimal levels of androgen. And we've known for 40 years because of resistance to methotrexate, which was a very commonly used and very poisonous treatment for many tumours back in the 1970s and 80s, that one of the enzymes, dihydrofolate reductase, amplified in response to methotrexate. So the androgen receptor is amplifying in response to these very potent anti-androgen drugs. That's the most common effect. The second most common effect is probably in the P53 gene, which allows cells to grow when the normal cell controls should be killing them. And that is also over-mutated once you get these resistant cells going through. So our very treatments are selecting for a new disease. And sometimes we ought to think about a new treatment for a new disease.
Now, quite clearly, there are some fascinating mechanisms going on in prostate cancer, and the scientists and indeed the clinicians have got quite a firm grip on many of them. What do you regard as the way forward for the busy cancer doctor? What are the things we definitely know, and what are the things we perhaps should be thinking about and beginning to implement?
In the UK, at least, docetaxel is still very much a frontline secondary treatment for prostate cancer. Only 30% of prostate cancer patients respond to docetaxel. Why is that? You know, if you could give a man docetaxel, reassured that he is the 30%, that would make an enormous difference. And it's such a small battle to win. And I'd love to think that that's a question that the scientists and the clinicians working together can answer.
That's one question. Yeah. Are there potentially others? And what kind of clinical pointers could you give at this point where we do understand a lot of the science and the genetics that's going on?
The other particular point really is when we treat prostate cancer. At the moment, there's a very, very good and very well-developed guidelines, but the recurrence rate is still very high. One of the talks at the conference today from Professor Sweeney from Boston suggested that we should be moving the treatment, the aggressive treatment, back a little bit. Now, there's been a bad press for over-treatment of prostate cancer with radical prostatectomy, and this is talking about chemotherapies. So moving that back to an earlier stage, a combined chemotherapy regime. And I'm all in favour of that because the genetics tells us that as the cancer develops, it becomes more heterogeneous and therefore more difficult to treat. So I can see that earlier treatment of men whose cancer has just started to break through the prostate, rather than wait and see if he's got metastasis, you have to assume he's got metastasis and treat it hard at that point.
What are the basic things about genomic profiling that the average busy cancer doctor really should be acquainted with?
Some of our clinicians were very anxious to embrace genomic profiling and were costing out whether they should have a DNA sequencer in the hospital. The DNA sequencing itself is actually not that difficult. It can be done in a room with a set of technicians. What's most important is that the clinician should provide the very best material for analysis, and that downstream there should be well-trained and clinically aware bioinformaticians to provide that information back to them.
And you think a lot of clinical benefits could ensue in the relatively near future?
I would love to think that would be the case, because at the moment, a new drug for prostate cancer offers an extra 2 to 3 months of life most of the time and costs a lot of money. Wouldn't it be nice to say to prostate cancer patients, we have the drug for you based on your genomic profile? That would be my dream, certainly.
And what would be your bottom line take-home message for cancer doctors right now?
Genomics is something that they should not be afraid of. For some of them, it may have been a very small part of their medical course. They should be re-educated in that. There's lots of courses which will allow them to do that. Know its limitations, know its strengths, and then become part of a revolution in how we type cancers.